Alexei Navalny was poisoned. I believe the poison was administered by the FSB, the Russian secret police. And I believe that the order was given to poison him by Vladimir Putin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. This is about Russia and an opposition figure who, as we speak, is in hospital fighting for his life after an apparent poisoning. Officially, Russia says he wasn't poisoned, but the wife and spokesperson of Alexei Navalny says he was after drinking a cup of tea at an airport in Tomsk. Navalny was on a flight to Moscow after campaigning against Putin's Russia United Party, calling the local officials their crooks. The airplane had to make an emergency landing at another city. And there a tug of war over the weekend between Navalny's wife and local officials to let him be flown out to a hospital in Germany. Finally, after a very public debate, Russia allowed Navalny to leave in a coma and in very serious condition. He is recovering in Germany. All right, joining me now is William Browder. He is an American-born British financier and political activist. He is the CEO and co-founder of Hermitage Capital Management, the investor advisor to the Hermitage Fund, which at one time was the largest foreign portfolio in Russia. And Bill, you've been banned from Russia. Your company's raided for tax fraud. That was a long time ago. You were convicted in absentia, and your lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was jailed in Russia and died in prison. You have had a long, long fight since then for some kind of justice in his case.
Yeah, my story is a long and ugly one where I invested in Russia. I discovered corruption in the companies I invested in. I exposed the corruption. And in retaliation, they expelled me from the country, declared me a threat to national security, raided my offices, seized all of our documents. My lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, investigated, discovered that the reason for seizing the documents was to use those documents to perpetrate a $230 million tax rebate fraud where the Russian authorities were stealing taxes, $230 million of taxes that we paid to the Russian government from the Russian government. Sergei exposed the fraud. He was then arrested by the people he exposed, put in pretrial detention, tortured for 358 days, and murdered on November 16, 2009. That was 11 years ago. Since then, I've been on a full-time mission to get justice for Sergei Magnitsky, which has led to a piece of legislation named after him called the Magnitsky Act, which imposes visa sanctions and asset freezes on the people who killed Sergei Magnitsky and the people who perpetrate other gross human rights abuses around the world. This is a the law was first passed in the United States in 2012. It was then globalized in 2016 to apply not just to Russians, but to people everywhere who did terrible things. It then went to Canada, Britain, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Kosovo, and it's currently on deck to be put in place at the European Union and Australia. It's something which Vladimir Putin has described as his single largest foreign policy priority to try to get rid of. The reason he hates it so much is because he steals a lot of money, he kills a lot of people, and he tries to keep that money safe abroad. And by having the Magnitsky Act in place, it puts his money and the money of his cronies at risk.
Let's start with what's happening right now. One of the main opposition candidates in Russia, Alexei Navalny, poisoned, it looks like, and he's fighting for his life in Germany. Who did it and why?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. You know, everybody says, well, let's reserve judgment. There's no proof, blah, blah, blah. But how many poisonings coming out of Russia have to happen before we can finally say it's obvious who did it? I mean, I believe that Alexei Navalny was poisoned. I believe the poison was administered by the FSB, the Russian secret police. And I believe that the order was given to poison him by Vladimir Putin.
Why blame Putin? I mean, Navalny, when you take a look at some of his investigations, and they have been very serious corruption allegations. I mean, he has covered so many people and touched so many different people inside Putin's circle.
That's true. However, Alexei Navalny is at such a high level in terms of his politics that nobody can touch him without the permission of Putin. Nobody would touch him without the permission of Putin, because if you did, it would set off a political firestorm that Putin would bear the brunt of. And so Putin would never allow that to happen. And everybody in Russia abides by this set of rules. So I don't believe that anyone other than Putin would have had the authority to do it.
And why would they do it now?
Well, this is a very pregnant moment in politics in this part of the world. You have the Belarus situation going on, and all you have to do is turn on the Twitter or the internet and look at the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are standing up to the dictator Lukashenko right now. And Putin watches this and sees this and understands that this Belarus situation may be uncontainable. I personally think it is. I've never, it really looks to me like this thing is spiraling out of control for Lukashenko. And it's one thing if you have a situation like that happening in a faraway country like Egypt or Tunisia, as far as Vladimir Putin is concerned. But it's another thing when it's Belarus, which is effectively almost like a province of Russia. And if the Russian people see that the Belarusian people can get rid of their dictator, they're going to have a lot more confidence that they could do the same thing in Russia. And if there was one person who is poised to lead that movement, it's Alexei Navalny. And so there's a really clear timing and political motive for why Putin would have done this right now.
And as we speak, there have been a lot of demonstrations inside Russia, despite Putin's and the Kremlin's statement all the time that he's got 80% popularity. A lot of people think he's lost a ton of popularity during COVID-19, that the referendum was rushed through because they anticipated these kind of demonstrations and unrest as the Russian economy is collapsing. And there have been demonstrations in the Far East kicked off because of the arrest of a governor there.
It's a total myth that Vladimir Putin has 80% approval rating. In a country like Russia, where you get arrested, you lose your job, you maybe even get killed for going against Vladimir Putin, nobody is going to answer honestly when they get called by an anonymous pollster to say, who do you support? I mean, the fact that 20% of the people say they don't support Putin is the only surprising thing to me about those fake polls. So, and you're absolutely right. You have a situation where the Russian people have given up free press, free speech, the ability to elect their leader of choice. And they did all that stuff on this unwritten bargain, which was if they give up all that stuff, they could enjoy a better standard of living. That was the deal that Putin had presented to them 20 years ago. But we're now in a situation where they've given up all their freedoms and the economics have been stagnating and then recently collapsing. And so there's like nothing to be gained from Vladimir Putin. And at this point, he's really in a terrible and tough spot, because it's not like he can just give up power, retire, enjoy his ill-gotten gains and live a quiet life afterwards. He's killed people, a lot of people. He's ruined the lives of many, many people. He's stolen so much money. And if he were to lose power, he would have to bear the legal responsibility for that. And he understands that if he were to lose power, he'd probably go to jail, he'd lose his money, and God knows, maybe worse. And so he has no choice but to try to hold it all together as best as he can. And the one thing that scares him more than anything is when tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people all decide at once that they've had enough. Because it's one thing to go out and imprison all the opposition leaders. It's another thing to try to imprison everybody, which is just not possible.
Does he create this atmosphere if he doesn't give the wink and a nod and say, yes, to the FSB or the GRU to carry out assassinations? Does he at the very least create this atmosphere where political assassinations are thought to be in his interest and with his blessing? And I'm talking about, you know, the shooting of Boris Nemtsov, which took place within the view of the Kremlin, and Anna Politkovskaya, going back a bit further, a journalist who had criticized Putin and what was going on in Chechnya, and she was shot outside her apartment.
There's always this sort of undercurrent of like allowing of giving Putin the benefit of the doubt to say he's created this environment and everyone's doing this terrible stuff. It's clear to me that Putin was responsible for Boris Nemtsov's murder. He's responsible for the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, and he was responsible for many other terrible crimes. Russia has a lot of chaos, but there's no chaos when it comes to the ordering of these crimes. And these can only be done, the big political crimes can only be done with Vladimir Putin's, not just blessing, but personal involvement. I would imagine that he was following every step of the process in the poisoning of Alexei Navalny and the subsequent crisis when he was hospitalized and trying to leave Russia.
So what do you think of President Donald Trump then, often just kind of sidestepping the Russia issue, even inviting him and suggesting to Angela Merkel of Germany and France to invite him back into the G7 again?
Well, I have my own personal experience with Donald Trump as it relates to Putin. After the Magnitsky Act was passed, Putin has been trying to get me back to Russia to effectively kill me like he has Sergei Magnitsky. I've been sentenced twice to 18 years in Russian prison. And during the 2018 summit in Helsinki, Donald Trump had this private meeting with Vladimir Putin. And at the press conference afterwards, one of the journalists asked Putin, are you going to hand over the 12 GRU officers that Robert Mueller wants for interfering with the U.S. election? And Putin said, it's not so simple as that. We might very well hand them over if Donald Trump hands over Bill Browder and the 11 American government officials who are part of his criminal enterprise. And then the journalist...
One of them, by the way, sorry to interrupt you, I want to hear all of it, but one of them was actually an ambassador, Mike McFaul, who he suggested, Trump suggested maybe there would be some kind of swap. I mean, unheard of.
Well, so they asked Trump, they said, well, what do you think about this? He said, I think it's a brilliant idea. And so they wanted to hand me over. They wanted to hand over, as you mentioned, Mike McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador to Russia. They wanted to hand over Kyle Parker, who is the chief of staff of the U.S. Helsinki Commission, who wrote the Magnitsky Act. They wanted to hand over Special Agent Todd Hyman from the Department of Homeland Security that was investigating Russian money laundering connected to the Magnitsky case in New York. It was absurd. And it took Donald Trump 4 days to walk it back. And it was only after the Senate was about to hold a vote in which they were going to vote 98-0 not to hand us over that Trump, about 20 minutes before that, issued a very meek statement saying, or I should say his press secretary issued a statement saying, we've decided not to pursue this request at this time.
Bill, can you tell me, I mean, long-term, how do we engage or deal with Russia? Maybe engagement is not something that you favor. But I mean, you know, the individual sanctions, the sanctions against Putin's inner circle have resulted in what? I mean, a very debatable result in terms of probably not containing Russia very well.
Well, you've got to do it properly. You can't do it halfway. So first of all, the obvious conclusion that one needs to come to with a country like Russia is that they're a major nuclear power, and so you have to talk to them. So you can't cut off diplomatic relations. And for Americans, but for Europeans, they're a major energy supplier, and so you can't just say, no, we can't do business with them because of the lights will go out in Europe. So those two things have to continue to happen. But at the same time, Russia is exporting assassinations. In the UK, they used polonium, radioactive material, on one person. They used Novichok, a chemical weapon, on another set of people. They're doing targeted assassinations all over Europe. They just did one in Berlin.
They may have taken out bounties on American soldiers in Afghanistan.
Indeed, they've shot down passenger planes with innocent people on board. They've invaded countries, redrawn the border, bombing hospitals and civilians in Syria. They're a major international menace. And so you can't let that go, because if you do, then they'll continue to do it and do it in greater numbers and more places. And so you have to create a punishing consequence, which it can't be cutting off diplomatic relations, and it can't be stopping business. And so the obvious consequence for them is targeted individual sanctions. And this is particularly powerful in a country where a few thousand people have stolen all the resources of the country and keep all those resources in the West. And it's, in my mind, it's not debatable at all how powerful these sanctions are. They hate them more than anything. And probably the most powerful of all the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia were the sanctions of the seven Russian oligarchs, which took place in 2018, shortly after the Election Hacking Act was passed. And those seven oligarchs, who are close trustees of Putin, effectively had their financial lives ruined. And if we wanted to really stop Russia in its tracks, they should expand that list and expand the list of other government officials who are targeted and sanctioned. Because and we have huge leverage here, because they keep all their money in the West and they care about their money.
If there is one hope that you would have to wrap this up, what would the Navalny attempted poisoning, attempted murder, lead us to?
Well, my main hope is that Alexei Navalny recovers completely without any disabilities, and he can go on to fulfill his democratic dream and the dream of the Russian people, which is to have a real democracy there.
And then you believe that he may return stronger?
Well, I think if he can survive this attempt, this assassination attempt, I think it only empowers him to do greater things. And Putin, he's not a legitimate leader like Lukashenko, and I think it's time for the Russian people to let him know that.
Bill Browder, pleasure to talk to you. You know, great background information on what you believe has to happen, and probably, you know, you have succeeded in bringing about so much change through the Magnitsky Act. You must be very proud, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mark Galeotti joins us now in London. He is a senior associate fellow at RUSI. It's the Royal United Services Institute, and it's a highly respected institute. We often go there as journalists to talk to analysts and experts. And he's also the author of a book, which I need to read, which is called We Need to Talk About Putin. Mark, let's talk about Putin.
Indeed.
Alexei Navalny, as we speak, is in a hospital fighting for his life in Germany. Do you think he was poisoned, and by whom?
Well, the first part's the easy bit. Yes, it seems almost certain that he was poisoned, and that's certainly also what we're getting actually out of Germany this morning. By whom? That's the tricky thing. We sometimes tend to think of Russia from a distance as being a totalitarianism where everything comes down from the top and Putin signs off on everything. He's actually, in many ways, a very lazy autocrat. And he's created a system whereby he often doesn't give very, very specific and explicit guidance, but sets broad areas of interest. And umpteen officials, oligarchs and such like scurry around trying to please the boss. So what we don't know is whether or not this was actually, shall I say, a Kremlin initiated hit, and I suspect not, for reasons we can talk about if you want, or whether rather it was precisely one of these other agencies, someone who had been burned by one of Alexei Navalny's anti-corruption investigations, or feared he was going to be, or some local official who somehow thought that this is exactly what the Kremlin wanted and he would be rewarded
I find it hard to believe, and I think a lot of other people would too, that Alexei Navalny, who is the highest profile opposition figure in Russia, that if somebody was going to poison him, that wouldn't have to be blessed by the Kremlin.
Except that, I mean, we have other examples of form. when Boris Nemtsov, again, one of the very high-profile opposition figures in Russia, was killed literally a stone's throw from the Kremlin. That does not seem to have been approved by Putin. In fact, it created a sort of quite a stir and a storm in Moscow. But it was actually initiated by Ramzan Kadyrov, the dictator of Chechnya, who incidentally is no fan of Navalny's. There are other figures who genuinely seem to be able to act.
By the way, Boris Nemtsov, for people who don't follow Russia, was the main opposition figure in Russia, extremely liberal. But at one point, he was chosen to be the successor of Boris Yeltsin, and he was a deputy prime minister, and I knew him very well. He ran for mayor in Sochi at one point to try and get a political foothold again, fighting for independence, and he was also a supporter of Ukraine. So certainly he was thought to be a foe of the Kremlin.
Exactly. So I think that it's often that people feel, they assume that this is what Putin would want. And in a way, the issue becomes not whether or not the Kremlin is innocent, but it's differently guilty. There are those hits which clearly the Kremlin initiated, and there are those hits which happen because the Kremlin has created a country and a system in which actually a whole variety of different agencies do use violence, up to and including murder, and can get away with it, and the state will still have their back.
I want to read a paragraph from the editorial that you wrote for the Moscow Times, because I think it's very well written and you're a great writer, and it's very clear, but you can just tell me what you meant by it. A state that kills is a terrible thing, but its red lines can generally be observed and it can ultimately be held to account. But a state that permits a whole range of actors and interests to kill with impunity is an even more uncomfortable thing, as the red lines may be invisible, intersecting, and mobile, and the challenge of accountability is even greater. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is precisely that the real challenge for people in Russia who are trying to still use whatever space there is for opposition politics, for civil society, for bringing this elite, this thoroughly corrupt, self-interested elite to account, they may think they know what is acceptable. And it may well be that it is acceptable today. But the point is, because there are so many other individuals who, in a way, draw their own red lines, you never really know when you're stepping over that. Let me give one example. I mean, I work on Russian gangsters and also the Russian intelligence service. And as a result, I've sat down with some deeply unpleasant people from time to time. One of the few people I have absolutely been warned off looking at carefully is a man by the name of Yevgeny Prigozhin, who's sometimes known as Putin's chef, though he wasn't Putin's chef, but who is a businessman who is behind, for example, the Wagner Mercenary Corporation that we've seen in Donbass, Syria, Libya, and elsewhere. And but basically, as well as, you know, he also incidentally ran the troll factory of infame from the last presidential elections in the States.
These are the troll factories that put out information and disinformation and were largely responsible for interfering in the American election in 2016.
Exactly. Now, this is a guy who's basically, I mean, it's worth mentioning a guy with a criminal record, who has done well precisely by doing whatever business the Kremlin needs doing. So basically, whatever it is, whether it's trolls or mercenaries or indeed setting up the kitchens to feed the army, he will do it. In return for that, though, he seems to have been given massive degrees of autonomy. I mean, he's been linked with the murder of Russian journalists who are looking into the activities of Wagner Group in Africa. He's been linked with all kinds of activities. And he's not unique in this. There are these figures within Russia who basically have set themselves up as almost we could think of as warlords. You know, if this was a medieval country, we'd have no trouble thinking them as warlords. Because they wear suits and everything else, we have trouble using the same vocabulary. But frankly, that's what they are. And this is the problem in Russia. There is a vicious and sometimes murderous state, but one which is actually in some ways relatively restrained. But then there are other figures who are unrestrained and even more vicious.
It's interesting that when Salisbury occurred, the poisoning of an ex-Russian GRU, a spy in Salisbury, that somebody asked me on air, is it disturbing that Putin would approve this? And I said, yes, but it's probably even more disturbing if he didn't, because that would tell you that the security services now were operating off the leash. Do you think that that is occurring? Does Putin have control of the security services, the FSB, the GRU, and others that are operating that may have carried out the poisoning of Navalny if, in fact, he was poisoned?
I think the answer is that Putin has the level of control that he wants to have. In other words, I think he absolutely chooses to step back from something. I mean, if we take the Salisbury poisoning, I do believe he would have signed off on it. I think anything that has a major international implication like that, such as, you know, a murder in the UK, I think that would have to cross his desk, even though it probably would be initiated by the other people. But they would just have to get the bosses okay. Something like this, domestically, a Russian citizen in Russia, I think the honest answer is it could have crossed Putin's desk, but it doesn't necessarily need to have done so. I think he's willing to allow these people a lot of autonomy. And then if they mess up badly, he will punish them. If they succeed, he will reward them. But the whole nature of the Putin's regime is that he wants these people desperately competing for his favor. I mean, that is the true currency of Russia. It's not the ruble, it's not the dollar, it's Putin's favor. If you have that, you can do anything.
Why do you think now? I mean, why would they go after Navalny now? Is it because of what's happening in Belarus and they fear that he is igniting potentially the same kind of fire?
Well, I'll give you two answers. One of them is it could be something that's very local and very conditional. I mean, we know that he was in Tomsk in Siberia, not just meeting local activists, but also engaging in one of his exceedingly forensic anti-corruption investigations. So it might be that just literally it was a local person, someone there who didn't want their grimy deals being exposed and therefore felt he had to do something about it. So that's a possibility. But the other one is, yes, you mentioned Belarus. We have this explosion of people power in Belarus. At the same time, there is a mood of dissatisfaction within Russia. We see it in Khabarovsk on the Chinese border, where for weeks now they've been protesting the arrest of their elected governor, not because they like him particularly, but because it's an example of Moscow just simply reaching in because he doesn't like the candidate. And anyway, the thing about Khabarovsk is it's not that unique or unusual a city. If it can happen in Khabarovsk, it can happen anywhere. We have local elections that are coming up in September. And Navalny in particular was championing this notion of what he called smart vote, which is essentially that people should be encouraged to vote for whichever candidate, whatever party they come from, who is most likely to displace the government's United Russia bloc. So it could be that in that situation, Navalny, who after all has generally been very, very good at knowing just how to stay on the right side of the red line, didn't notice that that line had shifted and that a new mood of concern has arisen and they decided no. Navalny is just too charismatic, too popular, and his smart vote system is too potentially dangerous for us to continue to allow him to operate.
Do you think Navalny has been removed? I mean, let's say he recovers. You know, the question is, does a lot of these people never go back to Russia? I would think that Alexei Navalny will try to go back because that's his raison d'etre. I mean, he wants to campaign against the Kremlin and he has been fearless in doing so. And if he goes back, is he more empowered? Have they just created a kind of political opposition martyr of sorts?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, Navalny himself, when he's asked, you know, how come he's still alive? His answer is precisely, well, actually, the Kremlin realizes that I'd be more dangerous to them dead than alive. Now, we'll see. I mean, obviously, depends how he recovers and what his mood is. But he has indeed shown himself to be indomitable in the past. I mean, he's been arrested 13 times. His brother has been sent to prison to bring pressure to bear on him. He was almost blinded when they splashed antiseptic dye on his face. And this is his second time he's been poisoned. If he returns, I think, I mean, it does give him that additional status, and particularly actually, and it's slightly fanciful, but you know, if one looks at kind of Russian cultural mythology, there is something about the figure who is prepared to literally put his life and everything on the line. You know, that becomes a very sort of powerful element. We see it in Russian folklore, in Russian history, and today. Now, I think the key other element of this is, so far, Navalny's anti-corruption and sort of anti-government movement has been very Navalny-focused, understandably. This might actually create the opportunity for a new rising generation of activists to really come into their own. And I think that's crucial, because the thing that Navalny has always lacked, not been able to properly do, is institutionalize his movement. Turn it from just simply being, you know, one guy with allies and supporters and a YouTube feed into a true national movement. This might help push things right over that edge point.
It may have backfired on whoever thought they would carry this out with the approval of the Kremlin.
Absolutely. I mean, to be blunt, I think the lesson that we've seen from truly successful, awful authoritarian regimes is, you know, if you're going to do it properly. Don't take half measures. And I think the notion that Navalny would be intimidated by this is, of course, wrong. The notion that his supporters are likely to be intimidated by this is likely to prove wrong. I do think that in this respect, it was a mistake.
Hey, Mark Gagliotti, thank you so much from the Royal United Services Institute and the book that I'm going to read, and I know you will too. We need to talk about Putin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The latest is Navalny will recover. No details yet on what his long-term prognosis will be. And the heartbeat of the Russian political opposition movement is as unpredictable as Alexei Navalny's own health. Will we ever know if Navalny was really poisoned? I think we will. These things have a habit of eventually coming out in Putin's Russia. That's Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. Please, we need you to subscribe to the podcast and share the link. We're growing. We need your support. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.